From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with record producer and author Sam Charters. Charters spent much of the 1950s and 60s traveling throughout the South, recording blues and folk musicians. Also today, a remembrance of Broadway director and choreographer Michael Bennett, who died Thursday at the age of 44. Rhythm guitarist Marty Gross is back to show off his stuff, and Ken Tucker reviews two classic comedies on home video directed by Preston Sturges. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is blues and jazz historian Sam Charters. He's one of the people who helped make the blues revival of the 50s and 60s possible. Some of the musicians who were at the forefront of the revival first had their work brought to the public by Charters. He's a white northerner who as a young man became fascinated by southern black music. During most of the 50s, he was based in Louisiana and traveled around the South making field recordings of forgotten and previously undiscovered performers. He's produced hundreds of albums of blues, Cajun, and Southern folk music, mostly for Folkways Records. In the mid to late 60s, he worked as head of artisan repertoire at Vanguard Records, where he produced the anti-war hit Fixin' to Die Rag by Country Joe and the Fish. From 1970 to 1984, Charters lived in Sweden, where he wrote his latest novel, Louisiana Black. It's about a middle-aged, middle-class black man who lives in the North and has lost touch with his Southern roots. Charters is also the author of two books about the blues. I asked Sam Charters about how he was first introduced to blues and jazz.
I'm one of those people who grew up in a family that had discovered jazz in the mid-20s. My father and my uncles had played in an amateur high school band, and in 1926 they were playing at a little lake in Michigan, playing arrangements of dance songs of the period. And someone said to them, well, you guys are okay, but you should hear the band at the next lake. So they went up to the next lake, and there was the Hoagie Carmichael Band playing jazz. And my family to this day has not recovered from it. And they instantly became jazz musicians. And so I just grew up with all of this. One of my aunts married a trumpet player who'd come out of Electra, Texas, with the whole Ray McKinley and that group. And so people would check in the house. Teagarden would be there hanging up on the clothes hanger because he was too drunk to stand up. And there were band rehearsals going on. And my uncles would disappear, and they would go off and turn out they'd hitchhike to New York to see who the latest trumpet player was in the Duke Ellington band. And I assumed everybody lived this way. At the same time, they were deeply involved in Bela Bartok's music, and they were deeply involved in theater. And there was just all of this going on. My uncles, when they were trying to court a girl, would play Bessie Smith records for them, which didn't go over very well, but they certainly went over very well with me. And it wasn't until I was really in my late teens that I discovered that what I'd had as a background was really very, very unusual.
Well, you spent your life in search of music. In the 1950s, you moved from the North to the South, based yourself in Louisiana, and started making field recordings of Southern blues musicians and singers. Why did you want to go specifically to the South, and why were you interested in blues? It was jazz that you were brought up on.
That's right, and absolutely, if you were interested in jazz at that time, New Orleans was the city to go because it was still alive. So I began playing clarinet with my own jazz band when I was 13 and really wasn't very good and was looking for models, and I always was very determined if I wanted to do something, I did it. So I went to New Orleans as a teenager and looked up a man there named George Lewis. And George, for $5, would let me sit in the kitchen with him, and we'd play two clarinet duets for hours. And we'd play a tune like High Society, and I'd play the melody, and George would show me 30 ways to play the chorus. And I'd read every word that you could read about jazz, and since I'd grown up with it, I thought I knew a lot. And then one day I met George on the street in the French Quarter. He was with Jim Robinson, this wonderful trombone player, George and Jim, and they were all dressed up. And I said, where have they been? They'd been to a funeral. Who had died? A trumpet player. I said, wonderful trumpet player, big band, trumpet player from the 20s. I'd never heard of him. And I'd read every word on jazz that had ever been published. So that night when I went to see George before the job, he always rested, so he was lying in his bed resting, and I sat at the foot of the bed, and he began telling me about all the history of jazz that we'd never known anything about. And suddenly I realized that this is what I was going to try to find out about. So for the next 7 years, I lived in New Orleans, on and off traveling at the same time, interviewing all the musicians, the black musicians who'd ever played there.
Did you have specific musicians you were going in search of, maybe musicians whose records you had on 78 RPMs and who'd never been heard of for the past 30 years?
Well, the ones I was looking for hadn't even been recorded, most of them. In New Orleans, it was all legends. You knew that there was someone Louis Armstrong had learned from, and you'd heard Louis, but who was the one he learned from? Buddy Petit, and Buddy Petit had never made a record. So it became a wonderful, intense search for ghosts, looking for men who died many years before, trying to catch an echo of what their music must have been like. I tried to find every living member of the first jazz band, the Muddy Bolden Band, trying to get them to hum me their trombone parts, hum me the part that the guitar player plays, trying desperately to get to something that was lost, something that was lost forever. But we still had a chance to get a glint of it, get some little memories of it somehow or other.
What kind of equipment would you take with you when you were going to record somebody performing?
When I first started recording, this is marvelous, it becomes sort of like the history of early photography. People don't realize the struggles we had. The early machines in the late 40s, which I couldn't afford, were simply wind-ups that had a heavy flywheel and always ran down. And then you could possibly get a new thing called a wire recorder, but they got all tangled up and had very low fidelity. And then you could get tape recorders, which was brand new. So I bought my first tape recorder in 1953, one of the very first cheap models. It had a little green eye that blinked at me. And the eye closed when I played two things too loudly on it. And it must have weighed, sometimes I thought it weighed several hundred pounds, but I carried the damn thing for 5 or 6 years, and I did 35, 40 records with it. I had a microphone that I stuck with me, and I hitchhiked around with that damn thing. And it wasn't until finally I went to Africa in 74 that I was able to take a really good battery-operated stereo tape recorder with me.
Well, you were traveling around the rural South. Did you always have electricity to plug the tape machine into?
In 1954, I'd heard of a group called the Mobile Strugglers, which was one of the last real, genuine skiffle bands in the South, playing with washboards and washtub bass and everything. So I went over, and I was very inexperienced, but I had my tape recorder, and I managed to get the washtub bass player out of jail, where he'd gone from drunk and disorderly, and managed to track the guys down. We were in a little shack neighborhood outside of Mobile, back in the sort of the woods, and I was looking for some place to plug in my tape recorder, because I had to plug it in, and the fella said, well, there's a house right there. I know those people. We'll go in there. So we went in and, of course, plugged in and everything, and I used the people's ironing board for the microphone stand. Of course, they didn't know anybody lived there. We'd simply broken into somebody's house. And the people came in later in that afternoon, and here was this recording session going on with the tape recorder, and by that point we'd managed to find some beer. I was incredibly embarrassed, but they were very, very kind about it. They understood, danced along with the playbacks. We had a great afternoon.
What kind of leads did you pick up on to find the musicians who you were interested in? How would you find out where they were? Well, you had to be like a detective.
I felt sometimes more like an insurance tracer or a skip claim tracer. I felt I was doing something like that. You try to find somebody who'd last been seen in a little town outside of New Orleans in 1924, and you could usually find them. You had to be patient.
You've also discovered musicians who no one, aside from local people, knew about before.
Oh, yeah.
One of them was Lightnin' Hopkins.
That's right.
Who's very familiar, I think, to people who listen to blues now. How did you first hear about him?
Well, it was impossible to not hear the blues as a jazz musician, even though we tried to keep the two separate. As early as the late 40s, the jazz groups I was playing with, we had one or two blues records that we would listen to, even though we knew nothing about it, nothing. And I heard over the radio. I was part of the black community in the early 50s, and the radios were on, and I'd hear Lightnin' Hopkins, who was a figure somewhere out of Texas, who was making some records for a funny little record company called Gold Star, which then went out of business. Lightnin' disappeared. But I always ate in a same sort of rundown restaurant in the French Quarter. And it turned out I was talking one day about Lightnin' Hopkins, and the cook said, "That's my cousin." And he at least directed me to Houston. And then once I got in the Houston ghetto, after about 3 days of asking around, I found a sister who who didn't know anything. Found a place where his guitar was in pawn. They didn't know anything. And finally, I was sitting in my car at a street corner, and a car pulled up beside me, and a man rolled down the window and said, you looking for me? And I said, you Lightning? And he said, that's right. So I rented a guitar for him, got a bottle of gin. We went back to the little shabby room where he was living, and we made his first LP.
What was it like?
It was marvelous. I'd never heard anything quite like it in my life. Lightning went on and did hundreds of records, some of them losing the intensity. But for me, this was the first time he'd had a chance to stretch out without time limits, to simply do a range of songs. So he wasn't having to worry about starting on time, stopping on time. I was sitting there with the microphone right in front of him, and so he could simply be free. And he'd always been working with an electrical guitar, and I'd rented him an acoustic. So he was playing with music he was hearing himself in a marvelous way. And for me, I'd come closer, I think, to the genesis of the blues than I'd ever come before, because Lightning was such an extraordinary artist.
Now, how old was he at this time?
Lightning would have been, been 49. I think born 1910, I believe.
Now, we have a recording standing by of Lightning Hopkins. Yeah. Is this from that first session?
That's right.
That you
this
recorded?
Is from the first song he did, the Penitentiary Blues, where he took the old work song about Ain't No More Cain in This Brazos and turned it into a blues.
Why don't we hear it?
Yep.
Penitentiary Blues. Time for another man. When it haven't been a thing poor Lightning done. They say he ought to been on Brad 19 and 10. But Russell drove pretty women just like he did ugly men. I'm Big Brad. Yes, here I come. Finna do time for another man. And ain't nothing poor Lightning done. Well, you ought to be ashamed. My mama called me. I answered, ma'am. She said, you tired of working. I said, mama, yes, I am. Papa called me. I answered, sir. He said, son, if you're tired of working, when the hell you going to stay there? I couldn't. No, I just couldn't help myself. You know a man can't help but feel bad when he's doing time for someone there. You better watch it all the time.
Lightning Hopkins recorded in 1959. I guess when you were recording the session with Lightning Hopkins that you weren't disappointed.
I couldn't believe it. Absolutely couldn't believe it, because I had, in all these years, been looking for the beginnings, been looking for the roots, which meant I was always working with older musicians. And quite often, even when they were playing for me, I was only getting a memory of what they had played like when they were young. And this was the first time I'd met someone really just at the height of his creative powers, someone who had the imagination, had the flow and the vitality.
Did this record change his life?
It absolutely did. He was completely flabbergasted by the whole thing. Here's this person just showing up, handing him a guitar, giving him $200 and disappearing. And appeared on a number of best record lists. It got rave reviews. In fact, whole spectrum, jazz, folklorists, everybody loved it. And all of a sudden, there were four more LPs by the end of the year, and his career started. We'd meet over the years. We'd encounter each other at clubs. And it was always a very good relationship. We did a lot of records together after that.
You were living in the black community in Louisiana and traveling in black circles in the South. This was the 1950s. The South was still segregated. You must have really stuck out a lot, one of the few people probably in black circles at that time, and one of the few white people in black circles in the South at that time.
It was always complicated because racism was an official policy of these small communities. It wasn't that simply people were prejudiced. It was simply the law. I was arrested a lot. I was picked up a lot. And I was scared a lot. Every person I talked to was immediately questioned by the local sheriff, the deputies afterwards. I remember I was looking for Robert Johnson in Mississippi, and I talked to a couple of people on a street in just one of the little towns there, Friars Point. And I got down to the end of the corner, and I was looking at my map, and I looked back, and a deputy had both the persons I talked to up against a tree. And all I simply asked them for was directions. But I was not a car they recognized, and I was white. Only wanted that. So I always had to be very careful, not only for my own sake, but for the sake of the people I talked with. In New Orleans, it was quite literally illegal for me to shake hands with a black musician on the street. And the streetcars were still with those damn signs you moved up and down saying white, black, segregated, and you had to move them up and down. And if you tried to do anything against it, you simply got people in trouble. And so when I'd go with the musicians into a bar, they'd always have to pass me off as a full-blooded Indian. He may look white, but he's a full-blooded Indian.
Well, that comment that you just made reminds me, too, that I wonder if you've ever felt at times like you were in an awkward position with a black musician you were recording, because especially in the 1950s when you were finding people who were really down on their luck a lot, who were poor, who hadn't—no one knew who they were, no one knew about their talents. They'd been in and out of prison, maybe. So you're coming from a more, advantaged, privileged background. You have the money to give them and so on. It's not exactly a position of equality. And when you have this political sense that's motivating your work, you can really feel the unevenness of a relationship like that. How would you deal with that?
There was no way to deal with it, because there was no way that they could understand enough of me or my background to in any way comprehend the complex nature of this. And also, they were very religious, most of them, and deeply conservative politically, and that here was someone who was essentially irreligious and rather radical, coming down and doing this for his own reasons. So they simply regarded me as a white recording boss. And the only possible relationship most of the time was that. And of course, I was endlessly trying to make it friendship, but it couldn't be. It would have been some of them wonderful ones like Big Joe Williams and things, they totally understood that they totally didn't understand. And they just accepted it all as some crazy cloud cuckoo land.
But it must be tough for you to have this identity as the boss man to someone whose music you really admire, because you don't see yourself as the boss.
No, and yet the only way I could make the thing happen, because to get better recorded sound, finally, I was using small recording studios and everything. And the musicians themselves had been waiting for a break or waiting to be rediscovered. They were very much part of the musical world. To us, they were quaint folk musicians, too, many people regarded them. But as far as they were concerned, they were pop stars or had been pop stars, and they wanted to be on the radio again. And what I did in the first book, The Country Blues, was I really exaggerated the romance of the search for these guys. So the book is incredible passages of purple prose about drifting around little towns in Texas. because I recognized that at that point I was the only one doing this. I had the whole South, so I simply needed help. So I didn't say I need help. I simply wrote the most romantic book I could think of about being a young white blues researcher driving around the South. So the book came out, and I went to Europe for a year, and I came back, and there were people in every small town in the South, young white college kids, and they found everybody. It was one of the great research projects. In 4 or 5 years, they found every living blues musician. Unbelievable.
My guest is blues and jazz record producer and historian Sam Charters. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Sam Charters is my guest. He's a record producer, music historian, and novelist. His new novel is titled Louisiana Black. Your days in the South doing a lot of field recording coincided toward the end of your stay with the beginnings of the Civil Rights Movement and the Freedom Rides. Yeah. How did that affect you? Did it make it any easier or harder for you
much
to
harder.
Do your work?
It got much more dangerous. At this point, you were dealing not only with local sheriffs and things, but the National Guards and with the all of their communication system. I remember one point with my wife, we'd taken a few pictures in the black ghetto in Birmingham, and the first white person that went past us in a car was stopped, and went right to the corner of the phone booth. We saw them phone, made a telephone call, and before we even could really get the cameras back and get in the car, there were two army vehicles, you know, just boxing in our car, and they just took us right to the edge of Birmingham.
Well, how did you spend the 1960s?
I was doing an awful lot of writing, and more after the country blues, I became very much in demand by record companies who wanted me to go south. I came back from my time in Europe. I'd been writing a novel in Edinburgh and came back, and I'd been back 2 days. I came back with $13, and 2 days later, I had immediately assignments to go to the south and start recording blues people again. So I had to find everybody that I'd found in the research for the book and make records with them. And then in 1964, Vanguard was involved in recording the Newport Folk Festival. And 1964, we gathered together every one of these blues musicians, and it was like heaven's going to be. There they all were in one house together, some of them meeting each other for the first time, going back to the world of the blues. There was Robert Pete Williams and Skip James and Sleepy John Estes and Robert Pete Williams and Reverend Wilkins. It was just incredible, just incredible. And then So Vanguard then asked me if I wanted to go to Chicago to record there. I said, well, they said, what should I do? And I said, go to Chicago. So they sent me there, and I did a three-volume series called Chicago, the Blues Today, which was the breakthrough for this audience for much of the Chicago blues. And then I went off from that after writing a couple of books. I went around the world and came back and stopped in San Francisco to see my friends just as the San Francisco scene was breaking, the whole psychedelic circus going on. So I went to New York and stopped by Vanguard, planning to just write another book. And Vanguard said, is anything going on? I said, San Francisco. So they sent me back out to San Francisco.
What a life.
I've heard an awful lot of good music.
Have people who've read your books, especially your new book, or heard your records, assumed that you were black?
Most do. And this has been difficult. It's been such a difficult point that for part of the 70s, I decided I would do no more work in the field of black music. So I didn't do anything from 70 until 73, expecting that a young black scholar would step in and do this kind of historical work. But because of the sensitivity involved, none did. So back I went and started again. And there were a series of books in the 70s, again, documenting the blues, documenting black music. But no, I had always felt this kind of sensitivity. But I the only thing that really put it in perspective for me was after my first blues book came out, The Country Blues, I was at a party with the Folkways office, and there was Langston Hughes. And Langston was telling me how much he liked the book. And I said, Langston, thank you, but you could tell me so much more about the blues than I'll ever know. And Langston looked at me and said, tell me something about Schubert that I don't know. And I realized at that point that this is simply something to learn about, and that it didn't matter what color or what your background was. If you set out to learn it and you were open, you could learn. And so this has been my final justification for continuing to absorb myself in it. Absolutely, there may be nuances I miss, but after all these years, there are a lot of nuances that I get, and I'll settle for that.
Let's talk about your new novel. Let me preface this by saying that it's about an American northern black man, middle-class man, who works, is he an accountant?
Yeah, he's an accountant for a small firm in Bridgeport.
And through finding a photograph of someone who he thinks is his father, mm-hmm. It's a photograph of him being lynched,
yeah.
He decides to leave for a while and go to the South to search out who his father was, why he was lynched, and in doing so he learns a lot about himself. It's written from the perspective of this black northern man, and it's interesting that you, as a white person who's lived so much within black communities, chose to write it from a black perspective.
I didn't in any way think of the anomaly that involved until the book was virtually done. And then I really became quite uncomfortable because I was in some way presenting myself as a spokesman for black consciousness, because it is an issue that I'm addressing, a black issue. But I had spent so much of my life being involved in the black community, and particularly in the 70s when I was in Sweden, I became very involved in recording in western Louisiana, working with a black group called Rockin' Doopsie and his Cajun Twisters. And I would literally be there months at a time, just living with Doopsie and his family, later staying in a local motel. And my whole orientation toward the United States in those years became simply through the black community. And so that when I came to write the book, I didn't even have any doubts when I began. Then I must say when I finished, I thought this was very presumptuous that I'd done this. And looking back on it, I am uncomfortable about it in a way, but I accept the fact that this is what I was driven to write.
What are your ethnic roots, or, you know, what are your roots? What would you be searching out if you did a very personal search?
Oh, I already did that. I'm from Scotland.
Did you really do that?
Yeah. My family's from Hoyk in Roxburghshire. And different branches came at different times, but the essential charter, I'm Samuel Barclay Charters, the fourth, the original Samuel Charters was the Bishop of Hoyk and wrote a history of local witchcraft and four or five studies on bashfulness and shyness at the 1790s and 1810s. And the family became actually very prosperous, very active in Pittsburgh in the 1870s, had chains of grocery stores and sold everything to. That's how they could afford to be gentlemen jazz enthusiasts. They all were in prep school together, and that was the difference.
I'm sure you have no second thoughts about how you've spent your life musically and in your writing.
It's difficult in the United States as a writer because there is, as you know, a very aggressive anti-intellectualism, and if you attempt to have writing that's political or specific, you're in trouble. But I must say there was so much exhilaration in the work I was doing that even though I couldn't concentrate on the creative prose that I wanted to, I still felt that there was enough to do.
My guest has been blues and jazz historian and record producer Sam Charters. His latest book is a novel titled Louisiana Black, published by Marion Boyers. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with syndicated columnist Joyce Maynard, whose new book is titled Domestic Affairs, Enduring the Pleasures of Motherhood and Family Life. So I hope you can join us. Let's listen to some music from the debut recording of Zydeco accordionist Rockin' Doopsie. This was produced by Sam Charters in 1976. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a look back at the life and work of Broadway director and choreographer Michael Bennett. Also, another quick lesson in the rhythm guitar, courtesy of Marty Gross. Ken Tucker reviews home video releases of two comedies by director Preston Sturges. And we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. Once a week, we invite a guest musician to perform. Today, we've asked back singer and rhythm guitarist Marty Gross to play and to talk about the role of the rhythm guitar in jazz.
To that land of jazz, let me hear the kind of blues that Memphis has. I want to step to a tune that's full of ginger and pep. Pick 'em up, lay 'em down, let me hear that razzmatazz. I want to give you fair warning, I won't be home before morning. Everybody loves a jazz bow in the loving land of jazz. Oh, in the loving land of jazz. Step to a tune that's full of ginger and pep. Pick 'em up, lay 'em down, let me hear that razzmatazz. I want to give you fair warning, I won't be home before morning. Everybody loves a jazz bow in the loving land of jazz. Oh, in the loving land of jazz, yeah. In that loving land of jazz, 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 jazz. In that loving land of jazz. That was Take Me to That Land of Jazz, and reminds me of the time when I was just a teenager in high school and I was searching for that elusive land of jazz. And I would try to find it by skipping school and going out to see big bands in theaters and movie theaters that they played in, and trying to hear the rhythm guitar player. The rhythm guitar player was the icing on the rhythm section cake. Very important, but because he didn't make much noise by himself, that was in the days when all the guitars were acoustic, there was no electricity. Often there was just one microphone in front of the band. That was for the singers, and the rest was all just done naturally. Why, often the guitar player would be the last to be hired and the first to be fired.
because they figured they could give him up before they could give up a fifth saxophone or a third trombone or something like that. However, the classy, big-name bands like Count Basie's and Benny Goodman's big bands always kept their rhythm guitar players. So that brings me to this tune, which is what the rhythm guitar player did. He played chord changes most of the time like this. That sort of thing behind the soloists. And this next song is just about that, just about playing chords. It's called Changes. It's by Walter Donaldson.
Changes, changes, that's all he can play. Strangers, changes, he plays them all day. So sweet, so I repeat. Changes, changes, just hear what I say. He plays those beautiful changes in different keys. Beautiful changes and harmonies. He starts in C and changes to D. He's messing around most any old key. What's that? Hear that minor strain. That's it, there it goes again. So many babies that he can squeeze, but he's always changing those keys. First change into B, change into C, change into D, as easy as the weatherman. Folks, he's getting kind of cold, getting kind of hot. Listen, I forgot, since he was a tot, he's been the talk of Dixieland. In different keys, beautiful changes and harmonies. He starts in C and changes to D. He's messing around most any old key. What's that? Hear that minor strain. That's it, there it goes again. Why, there's so many babies that he can squeeze, but he's always changing. He's rearranging, he's always changing those keys. Dun, dun, dun.
That was rhythm guitarist Marty Gross. His latest recording, Marty Gross Sings of Love and Other Matters, is distributed by Statiris Records. We'll hear more from Marty Gross over the summer.
Da, 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 da. Ba, do, do, do. Ba, di, 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 di. Da, 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 da. Ba da 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 da.
You're listening to Fresh Air. We're going to take a few minutes to remember Broadway director and choreographer Michael Bennett. Bennett died Thursday at the age of 44 from cancer as a result of AIDS. Bennett will be best remembered as the creator of the hit musical A Chorus Line, the longest-running show in Broadway history. But long before that show made him famous, Bennett was a much sought-after choreographer. His credits include collaborating with Stephen Sondheim and Hal Prince on Company and Follies. Just a few days before his death, his 1981 hit, Dreamgirls, was revived on Broadway. I spoke with Michael Bennett in 1985 when he was in Philadelphia with the touring company of Dreamgirls. Bennett told me that as a young boy growing up in Buffalo, New York, he knew he would someday work on Broadway.
I used to come every summer when I was from 11 on, and I would go see all the Broadway shows, and I knew I wanted to be just like Jerry Robbins. He was my idol then. And that, I was very unhappy that I wasn't born in New York. It was like a tragedy. I wanted to be born right on 44th Street in Schubert Alley. I think that would have been perfect for me.
I know that Jerome Robbins has been a great influence on you, and you really admired his choreography. Mm-hmm.
I have only worked with him for 2 hours, my whole
2 life.
2 hours?
Is that all?
Yes.
I mean,
when I
it was
played
more.
Baby John in West Side Story when I was beginning my career, we were going to Europe for a year. And he came in because one of his dance captains had staged the company and everything. And he came in for 2 hours and rehearsed for 2 hours. He gave me one note on one step. Make my arms straighter.
And did that stay with you for the rest of your life?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have done many, many steps where my arms are not always straight, But for that step, they were straight every single performance I did.
When you first came to New York, what you were doing on Broadway was dancing in choruses. Was that your ambition? Did you know what you wanted to do?
No. At 11, I wanted to be just like Jerry Robbins. But, I mean, Jerry Robbins started as a chorus dancer. I mean, all choreographers start in the chorus. You start as a performer. You become an assistant choreographer. Then you become a choreographer. And then, the director and then producer. I mean, with me, it varies with other people. Most people are satisfied doing one or two things. I happen to be a workaholic and a control freak, so I like to have my hands in everything.
How did Chorus Line come about?
The truth is, actually, Chorus Line came out of the Watergate hearings. because it was an idea that I had, and what activated me to do the show was I sat for that summer, remember that famous summer? And I watched those hearings, and I thought, God, we don't have heroes anymore. It's very hard for us now, because the country went through quite an emotional crisis. We couldn't trust our leaders. And I went, but wait, the American people are still great. And I mean, Chorus Line says that in a way. It says we collectively are wonderful. I believe that to this day,
Were the stories in A Chorus Line based on stories of friends of yours?
Yes. I mean, mixed up. Like one character's made up out of half of this girl's life and half of that girl's life and some funny lines.
Did you get any of those friends to actually play the roles?
Yes, some of them did. Some of them didn't.
I always think that auditions for you must be really hard now because you've written the musical about how their personality and identity isn't always revealed during that first audition, and they have so much on the line. And they really are individuals. They're not just faceless chorus line dancers. And there you are judging thousands of people.
Well, Chorus Line goes a little deeper than I normally do at auditions. But it is very important to talk to people in an audition. But also it's about chemistry of a cast. I mean, there are people who are neurotic and talented, and there are people, and it's worth putting up with the neurosis, but there are people that are destructively neurotic in terms of a whole company. And you must get a chemistry of a company not only to be able to do the show and do it brilliantly 8 times a week, but to be able to get along.
How can you tell in the short time that you have in those initial auditions if someone's going to be destructively neurotic?
I always audition people 3 times before I hire them.
What do you ask for in a typical audition?
Well, if I'm starting with dancers, I ask for a double pirouette and a time step. And you can tell if people have had any training. And that's all you need to see. And that first, and I eliminate down. Then I actually teach combinations and dance styles and find out. Then you know exactly how much training they've had. And then you ask them about it. Then you talk to them. Then they sing. Then they read. And there's I never hire anyone I don't see 3 times. Because somebody can be wonderful in a first audition. And then something happens in the second. Or they're great 3 auditions and you're just, you're thrilled and you write the part and you make it bigger.
Have you ever made any big mistakes with casting?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? Can you fire them?
You have to. I mean, it's for the good of the whole show. You can't let a show go down for one person. You just can't. It's very hard to do. But you have to.
Steel yourself beforehand. Do you do it yourself? Do you do the firing yourself?
I always do it myself.
It sounds like that's important to you, to do it yourself.
Well, it's my mistake. It's not their mistake. If I miscast them, it's my mistake. And okay. I owe them an apology.
Were you surprised at a Chorus Line success?
Sure. Thrilled. Ecstatic. Nothing had ever happened like that before in the theater. It's the longest running show in history. And it's mine. It's amazing. And it's the story of my life on top of it. It's amazing. And by the way, it isn't lonely at the top.
It is not lonely.
It's, no, it's not. It's crowded is the truth of it. And I mean, success is hard to deal with. But it's harder. It was very hard on my family.
The
and the people around me, the success, yes.
Why
and people get afraid
it?
Of losing you.
Because of all the competition for your time and,
yes,
and emotion?
Yes. Well, I was running around the country. I mean, I had 5 companies of Chorus Line going at one time. That I was, you know, I was on a plane for 5 years. I didn't have time to do new things. That's why I didn't do the Chorus Line movie. That's something I did 11 years ago and worked on for years. I just let someone else do it. I mounted new things. I mean, an artist must stay fresh. You must keep that mechanism going every day and creating, or you can be in terrible trouble.
How did you become involved in Dreamgirls?
In Dreamgirls, Tom Ion and Henry Krieger, who were the writers, brought the idea to me.
How did they pitch it to you? What did they tell you?
They
about?
Brought 16 songs and an outline for a story, and I put them into workshop. Because I have a process which is called the workshop process, which is the way I did Chorus Line. And it's 4 6-week rehearsal periods, and you try out parts of the show. And you fix a show and shape a show around the performers. And without the pressure of being in a hotel room in Boston and a deadline and being in previews. And when you're satisfied with what's in the room, then you raise the $6 million and you go out and you do the musical.
Everyone describes Dreamgirls as being patterned on the story of the Supremes. How literally is it really patterned on them?
Well, the Supremes were, of course, the most successful of the girl groups. There were many, many girl groups. There were many cast changes in those girl groups. I knew the Supremes very well because I was a dancer on Hullabaloo, an assistant choreographer, and they used to do the show every 2 weeks. But it is not the story of the Supremes. Now, if it were the story of the Supremes, believe me, I would have been sued.
Was it fun being a dancer on Hullabaloo?
Was it fun? No, it was a concrete floor. It was. Yes, it was. Of course it was. I mean, because every rock act, all the English rock acts, Sonny and Cher, and Stephen Eady and Sammy Davis were the hosts, and the guys from Uncle. I mean, you just got to know everybody. But it was a concrete floor, and we used to jump up and down and shake. And it was, you know, when the Frug came in and all of that, we used to have such headaches because we'd, you know, for 2 days we'd be in that studio. After rehearsing for 3 days, we used to do 9 or 10 numbers a week.
On Hullabaloo, you had to dance in cages sometimes, too, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, God, yes. But I mean, I loved it. I just had headaches.
If you dance on Hullabaloo so much, I guess you didn't have to watch tapes to see what the girl groups and soul groups were up
to
in terms of their
choreography. No, I had to do no research to do Dreamgirls.
Right. What's the difference on Broadway between what the director does and what the choreographer does?
The work should be seamless. The truth is you should never know who did what. But I think director-choreographers are more successful with what has happened to the musical. Because the musical numbers, I mean, in the old days, you know, Agnes DeMille, there would be a ballet, and that was a big innovation. The ballet had something to do with the show. Because before that, there used to be this play, and then the dancing girls would come out in the middle while they changed sets behind a drop. I mean, now it's all integrated. The dancing tells, a dance number should tell as much about the plot as the next scene, like the next song does.
You've worked with Hal Prinz.
Yes. I've worked with everybody, which has been wonderful. Do you know? I've worked with Burt Bacharach and Hal Prinz and Alan J. Lerner and Stephen Sondheim and Richard Rodgers. I mean, to name composers. And then Neil Simon. I mean, I've been very, very fortunate, and I've learned from everybody.
Broadway director and choreographer Michael Bennett from an interview we recorded in 1985. Michael Bennett died Thursday.
Once, singular sensation, every little step he takes. Once, thrilling combination, every move that he makes.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
More deaths in Haiti today. Three people were killed earlier this morning. And protesters are now calling not just for reinstatement of election rules, ensuring fair elections, but also that Haitian leader Henri Namphy step down. Also, President Reagan chose this 4th of July eve to head for the Jefferson Memorial and introduce a new Bill of Rights. In his version, it's an economic Bill of Rights.
Any stories on July 4th celebrations?
Well, as a matter of fact, we do. We have a couple, and one is that we visit a fireworks stand, not so much to find out what's the latest in sparklers, but find out what the people do the rest of the year.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you want to distract yourself from the summer heat, you might want to try a good comedy. Two classic films by director Preston Sturges are now available on home video cassette. Critic Ken Tucker has this review.
The brilliant comedies that director-writer Preston Sturges filmed in the 40s and early 50s represent one of the high points in American movies. Packed to bursting with jokes, slang, literary allusions, and bits of wisdom, Sturges' movies represent the brainiest slapstick ever made. Two excellent examples of the Sturges style have just been released on video cassette. The Palm Beach Story from 1942 stars Joel McRae and Claudette Colbert, whose love affair almost never occurs. Funny, absurd situations keep interrupting this budding romance during a cross-continental train trip. Also on cassette is The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, made in 1944. Many Sturges fans say that Sullivan's Travels or The Great McGinty was the best film he ever made, but Miracle of Morgan's Creek gets my vote. Eddie Bracken stars as a patriotic fellow rejected by the World War II Army as 4F. Eddie's just too darn nervous. He meets his match in Betty Hutton, who gives a genius performance as a wily featherbrain. Like all Preston Sturges films, the dialogue flies thick and fast, as in this scene, in which Hutton uses a date with Bracken to get to a dance where there are soldiers she admires more than 4F Eddie.
Call off that military dance. Papa just called it off as far as I was concerned.
Oh, he did. Well, he probably had pretty good reasons then. That's what parents are for, to listen to their advice. I was always miss losing my parents so much.
I know, Norval, but he didn't have a good reason. He's just old-fashioned. Soldiers aren't like they used to be when he was a soldier, you know, all in France and like that.
Oh, aren't they?
Of course they're not. They're fine, clean young boys from good homes, and we can't send them off maybe to be killed and rockets, red glare, bombs bursting in air without anybody to say goodbye to them, can we?
They probably got their families.
Well, even if they have, they'll have girls and dancing and... How about those who haven't got any families? How about the orphans? Who says goodbye to them? You ought to know about them.
The superintendent probably comes down from the asylum for old time's sake.
Norval, I think you're perfectly heartless. I just hope you get into the Army someday, and the last thing that happens to you, the last thing you get before you sail away, the last thing you have to treasure while fighting beneath foreign skies is a kiss from the superintendent.
The Miracle of Morgan's Creek features ferociously funny supporting performances by Sturges stock players like William Demarest, Franklin Pangborn, and in a woefully neglected bit of magnificent sarcasm, Diana Lynn as Betty Hutton's bratty kid sister. The Miracle of Morgan's Creek is, as Pauline Kael once wrote, part of our great crude heritage. These films are ideal video cassette fare. The dialogue is so fast and juicy, you'll want to scan back and watch whole scenes again and again to pick up the stuff you missed. After Sturges, modern comedies seem thick-tongued and slow, but among the more agile recent releases are Something Wild, director Jonathan Demme's brave attempt to update the Sturges style for the 80s, and The Golden Child, Eddie Murphy's deadweight adventure comedy. There's also No Mercy with Richard Gere and Kim Basinger. It's not supposed to be a comedy, but believe me, it is.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Thank you.
Here's what's coming up on our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Private Detective Irwin Bly. He says, give him a shred of information about someone and he'll give you back a biography. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis will review an album that joins the Modern Jazz Quartet with the New York Chamber Symphony. And television critic David Bianculli will review Werewolf, the latest offering by Fox. He'll also chart the progress of this fledgling network. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.